Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, my name's Adrian Goldberg. Thank you for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast. This week, we reveal there have been two calls a day to a government hotline set up for pupils thought to be at risk of being radicalised, but are teachers sometimes overreacting after being placed under a legal duty to report fears of children turning to extremism? Plus, the salesman turned whistleblower at the heart of the UK's longest trading standards trial.
Across the UK,
this is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
Good morning. Today on 5 Live Investigates, we've discovered that two teachers a day are calling a government hotline about fears that children might be turning to extremism. But what happens when those concerns aren't justified? New laws introduced last summer placed a duty on teachers to take action if they believe a pupil is in danger of becoming radicalised. But are some overreacting and putting community relations at risk? We'll hear a 10-year-old talking for the first time about his ordeal after saying he lived in a terrorist house rather than a terrorist house. And a 15-year-old also questioned by the police after clicking onto English Defence League and UKIP websites in the classroom. We'll take your comments and stories as well. Drop us a text to 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, or on Twitter, we're at BBC5Live. Claire Savage has been investigating this for us. And Claire, what we're talking about is the government's prevent policy and a prevent duty being placed upon teachers.
Yes, prevent is part of the government's strategy to combat extremism and to stop people being drawn into terrorism. And last summer, new laws were introduced under the Counter Terrorism and Security Act. It's called the Prevent Duty, and it placed a legal obligation on schools in England, Scotland and Wales to identify children and young people at risk of being radicalised.
So what's the problem with that?
OK, well, from the outset, the new duty on schools has been controversial. Some teachers feel it's creating a climate of fear so that topics that would usually have been openly discussed in the classroom are now being driven underground. Other teachers say they feel duty-bound to refer pupils to the police or social services without being able to discuss the issue any further with that child.
So undoubtedly, these are difficult decisions for teachers. How can you tell whether a student making an off-the-cuff remark or a comment represents a threat to society? Or has just made an innocent mistake? You might remember the case of a 10-year-old boy who said he lived in a terrorist house when he meant a terrorist house. Well, the lad in question is called Rahim. He was asked by his class teacher to make up a fictional character as part of an English lesson, so he did, saying that he lived in a terrorist house and that he had been hit by a relative. The next day, a social worker and a police officer came to his house. I went to see Rahim at home in Lancashire, along with his parents and his 15-year-old brother, Naheem. Rahim showed me the schoolwork that had caused him and his family so much distress.
It was English and she told me to create a believable character.
So your teacher told you to create a believable character?
His name was Cheeky Charlie and he lived with his uncle.
His name was Cheeky Charlie, lived with his uncle, yeah.
He had a friend called Snutty Sam.
Was this character, was this you, or was this a different person to you?
A different person.
There were a couple of things that you know that people were concerned about when you wrote Cheeky Charlie, aren't there? I live in a terrorist house with my uncle.
Well, I meant that I live in a terrorist house with my uncle, but I didn't know how to spell it.
So in a terrorist house, did you mean?
Yes.
It was just a mistake.
Yes.
You do live in a terraced house, don't you?
Yes.
Do you live with your uncle?
No.
You wrote that, "I hate it when my uncle hits me." Why did you write that?
It was a movie that I found out that his uncle hits him.
It was a movie you'd been watching. What happened in the movie?
Uncle hits his nephew.
The uncle hit the character, the person in the movie, yeah? Did your uncle ever hit you?
No.
So when the police came to your house to ask you about this character that you'd created, what did you think?
I was confused.
You were confused. And did the police officer ask you questions?
Oh, he asked me about how I found out about terrorists and where my laptop is.
How did you feel when you saw a police officer in your house?
Scared.
Do you know anybody who is a terrorist or says good things about terrorists?
No.
Yeah, I'm Naheem and I'm 15. I'm his brother. When I came, my brother was crying. I've never seen him cry that bad. And I asked the police officer why he was crying. So they introduced me to his work. But I could not believe that he wrote that. So they started asking me questions like, is the mosque connected to this kind of stuff? And I replied by saying that the mosque does not tolerate that kind of stuff. They condemn it all the time.
So from your point of view, the questioning from the police was very targeted towards this question of terrorism.
Yes.
And what did you think of that, having seen what your brother had written?
I knew it was a mistake because he's never talked about terrorism at home. He's never talked about it to his friends or his cousins. And we've never let him see any news about terrorism.
How would you describe, then, how the authorities handled this?
I think it was an overreaction of something very small, because all kids make mistakes and it's a teacher's job to correct him. Because why do they go to school if they're not going to get corrected for small mistakes? Just disgusting the way we've been treated, just over a mistake.
I'm Rahim's mother. I can't envisage the blame my Rahim has been put through. I do not want my child to be blamed in this way. I want my child to be fine. My child has not been out to play with anyone. How is it possible to blame my child in such a way? All children are looking at him in a different way. How can they blame him in this way? We cannot think about terrorists. We do not know what being a terrorist is.
Is there anything in the house or with any family members that would encourage your son to talk about or think about terrorism?
We do not converse in this way. I am very soft-hearted. I cannot see anyone suffering. I don't talk about terrorists. I've always advised my children, do not listen to such idle talk or get involved in such conversations. I'm disheartened by all this. We don't talk in this way.
So that's young Rahim's mom, who, along with Rahim and his brother Naheem, were talking for the first time to journalists to this programme. I should say Rahim has moved to a new school and is doing well. But Claire, what do Lancashire Police and the County Council say about the way he was treated?
Well, they both strongly dispute this had anything to do with the anti-terrorism strategy Prevent. They say they only became involved because Rahim wrote in his story that he was being beaten by this relative, and that their response was low-key and proportionate and quickly established that no further action or investigation was needed.
But in our interview there, we heard from the boys that they were asked about terrorism. That doesn't sound like just a safeguarding inquiry into possible physical abuse.
The family believe there was a Prevent or terrorism component to the questioning. The family showed me a note made by one of the boys shortly after the visit by the police and social worker, and it lists some of the questions put to the boys. As Naheem said in the interview there, one says, is the mosque linked to teaching kids about terrorism? And it's worth stressing the family have always maintained that Rahim was not hit by a relative.
This isn't the only case like this either, is it?
No, another Muslim family actually contacted this programme a couple of weeks ago and gave a very detailed explanation of what happened to them. They say they were questioned under Prevent after their son had a bit of banter with other children in the playground one day. Now, these other pupils told him he wouldn't be allowed in a limousine that had chocolate in it to take them to the school prom. And the boy then joked to get the chocolate he'd use bombs and guns.
And that led to a police interview. There was another story recently as well, people might have heard, about a child who was referred to the authorities after drawing a cucumber.
Yes, this was a four-year-old boy whose nursery teacher thought the word cucumber was cooker bomb and then reported the child to the authorities. Although no further action was taken in that case, the child's family were upset with the way they'd been treated.
Well, let's get a word now with Mikdad Versi from the Muslim Council of Britain. Mikdad, good morning to you. What do you make of what we've been hearing?
I think that there are many cases, unfortunately, like this that have been taking place across the country. And I think this is, unfortunately, a natural consequence of this broad approach that seems to have three main problems with it. The first of which is this idea that some sort of viewpoint or ideology has a direct link to terrorism, and that by enacting this duty, we're likely to prevent terrorism. Unfortunately, there's no evidence to support this idea, and there's no real understanding of what the extremism they're really going to target. So that's the first real concern. The second is that many of these issues would not have gone any further had it not been a Muslim involved. There, of course, there are cases, and I think you'll be talking about them later, which are not related to Muslims. But if, when it comes to these specific examples, if a non-Muslim had done some of these things, we have had examples from teachers who've talked to us and said that wouldn't have resulted in any action. And the third area of problem is the lack of transparency. It's not, it's very, very difficult to understand or find out how many of these cases there are. We seem to have an idea that about 80% of cases that are referred in the first place don't go any further, but it's very difficult to know this for a fact because there's a lot of a lack of transparency on this whole process.
But we do also know, don't we, Mikdad, that some youngsters have gone, for example, to Syria to become jihadi brides, to marry members of this group calling itself Islamic State. Isn't it right, then, that the government should place a duty upon teachers, upon other adults in care of children, to ensure that those at risk of being radicalised don't go off and join Islamic State in Syria?
The question really is whether this policy is a very heavy-handed approach to deal with this issue. Everyone will recognise that there are real concerns out there, but is the right approach to have this broad net approach that probably wouldn't have caught these individuals concerned?
In the cases that we've heard, though, the police have said, look, or the authorities have said, these are proportionate responses, they're low-key.
I don't know whether having a police officer come to your house and discuss with a young child and the parents about terrorism is necessarily considered to be low-key by the parents themselves. I think that we have to recognise the fact that at the moment it's very, very worrying if someone comes to your house and says, you know, does your local mosque teach you about terrorism? That very question is problematic. And we have to realise that, from my experience with talking to people in Northern Ireland, these same measures are not being taken place there. Is there a reason why, even though the threat of terrorism, according to the MI5 in Northern Ireland, from Northern Irish radicals or terrorists, is severe and has been severe for the last for as long as we've had it? More people have been killed in Northern Ireland than in the UK since 7/7.
In the rest of the UK. Mikdad, just stay there if you would. I just want to hear some testimony now from a deputy head teacher who is in charge of safeguarding at her school. And she feels this prevent duty has helped teachers to intervene when a pupil might be vulnerable. She wants to remain anonymous, so we've revoiced her words.
Our student had been away on holidays to North Africa, and she was a Muslim student. She came back completely in a hijab, a burqa covered from head to toe, wearing gloves, you know, completely different to when she left, wearing her Western clothes. Her attendance and grades started to slip, and her friends were becoming concerned that she was isolating herself from them.
It's a very difficult area to assess, though, isn't it? Because in the case of that pupil, who is to say that she hadn't just taken it upon herself as a teenager to explore more deeply her religion, to adopt a more conservative form of dress?
Well, in fact, that's exactly what she'd done.
But presumably the fear was, what, that she may have been in some way radicalised, that she might be vulnerable to becoming an extremist?
We were able to put her in contact with other Muslim women who were able to give her a more rounded view and a response to those questions that she was asking, which was incredibly positive for her.
Is there anything big brotherish about the fact that she is then intercepted, as it were, by the authorities and encouraged to have a particular view of her own religion?
Well, from a safeguarding point of view, it's making sure that all of our students are safe, well and happy. Of course they try different things, but we have a duty to ensure that they're experimenting within safe parameters. We see the prevent strategy as being positive, as being another safeguarding issue that we need to ensure that our students are properly informed and protected, as are families.
What's happened to the girl now?
She's gone on to university and is, as far as we know, happy and healthy.
So Mikdad Versi from the Muslim Council of Britain, in that case then, the prevent duty just being seen as another element of ordinary, proper safeguarding of children.
I mean, of course, safeguarding is a vital component of education. It's something that we support and are encouraging across not just schools, but across mosques and any community organization that has engagement with young children. But the important thing here is, why does there need to be a specific duty here? In this case, for example, would a school not automatically look at something where there has been a massive change in a young child and their education has suffered? That would be a normal part of a school's work. There's not something special here which says, oh, you know what, this is a potential radicalization case that wouldn't have been dealt with in a similar way previously. If it's all about providing resources to teachers, that's fine. When it comes to sort of looking at young children as potential security threats, that's where the problem lies.
Mick Dadversi from the Muslim Council of Britain, thank you. Claire, what do the government say then to criticism that the Prevent programme and the Prevent duty upon teachers has left some members of the Muslim community feeling alienated?
Well, they say Prevent explicitly tackles all forms of terrorism and non-violent extremism, including far right-wing and Islamist extremism threatening the UK. They say the most significant of these threats is currently from terrorist organisations such as ISIL in Syria and Iraq and Al-Qaeda associated groups, but all forms of terrorist activity pose a threat to our safety and security, the government says. And they're working with hundreds of mosques, faith groups and community organisations to challenge those who spread hatred and intolerance.
OK, well, coming up, we'll hear from the 15-year-old referred to the police after accessing English Defence League and UKIP websites at school. Getting your reaction to what you're hearing as well. Drop us a text to 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk or on Twitter, we're at BBC 5 Live.
On DAB Digital Radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
On 5 Live Investigates today, the school children who find themselves suspected of extremism. Since last summer, teachers in Britain have had a legal obligation to report kids who do or say things that might suggest they're being radicalised. But as we've been hearing, sometimes youngsters and their families feel the process has been unfair and their communities stigmatised. Digital Maverick says, what did the government expect when they set the Prevent programme in motion? Alan Kilcoyne says, once again, massive pressure applied to teachers not to miss anything that they weren't originally trained to do. But Teacher Raw says, oh, for pity's sake, teachers aren't to blame. The Prevent strategy is the government's invention and we warned it was unfit. Keep your comments coming. Text us on 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, on Twitter, we're at BBC5Live. And of course, as we've already heard from the government, teachers aren't just on the lookout for children who are being groomed by Islamist extremists. Let's hear from one young man, 15-year-old Joe Taylor, as well as his dad, Mick. Joe's school in Hampshire called in a police officer to speak to him after he says he clicked on to an English Defence League and UK Independence Party website during a technology lesson.
We was in an engineering lesson at school and we were having a discussion with a teacher. We were talking about immigration, and we just decided to look it up, and it led to the EDL page, and we clicked on that, and we scrolled down, we didn't click on anything on that, and went off of it. And then the following day, we went on the UKIP website, just scrolled down that, looked at that, didn't click on anything, and the school said that I've got flagged for this.
On that basis, do you think there was any justification for sending a police officer from the Prevent team to see you?
I don't think there was any need for them to send a Prevent officer from the police team to come and see me. I think they took it out of proportion quite a lot and it wasn't needed.
And what kind of questions did they ask you?
They just asked me what my interests were. Do I have anything? Am I agree with the EDL? I said no, because I don't. And they just asked me if I was a UKIP activist, which I found very interrogating, as I'm not. So it was kind of some of the questions that they asked. I was kind of a bit stunned at, because I didn't understand some of them.
Stay there, Joe. I'll come back to you in a moment and ask you a few more questions. That's really interesting, though. Thank you for that. Mick, tell me, from your point of view, what happened to your lad?
We entered the room and we sat down, and the Prevent woman said, oh, I'm trained in people that are being groomed for ISIS and groomed for extremism. And I said, excuse me, hang on a minute, I need to know what sites were accessed. So the teacher looked at me and said the first site he accessed was EDL and the second site was UKIP, the policewoman from Prevent. She asked me my political views and I said, well, My dad fought in the Dorchester Regiment in the Second World War for 7 years. He died very young, so I said passions do run extremely high when we talk about our country, because my family shed a lot of blood for the country.
Have you, or has anyone you've ever associated with, been connected in any way with political extremism?
No.
Joe, let me come back to you. How have other people reacted to this?
A lot of people, students from the school and adults that have read this, think that school have gone a bit too far, and why would school be so one-sided on such a thing, really?
So that's Joe and Mick Taylor from Hampshire. Claire, what have the schools said?
The school says it didn't make a referral under Prevent, and the head says the police were contacted for advice and the police asked for a meeting with Joe and his dad at the school. Following that, no further action was taken. The school says its aim was to keep Joe safe, although they acknowledge it would have caused him some distress. They say their decision to talk to the police wasn't linked to him viewing the UKIP website. Hampshire police say the matter is now closed.
Yeah, but again, Claire, we're being told this was not a referral through the Prevent programme, although clearly it was passed to the police.
Well, I think what's happening is that the Prevent duty on teachers is leading them to raise concerns. And then there's a decision about whether it actually merits a Prevent referral, or it's seen as a broader safeguarding matter. In some cases, this might even be dealt with in-house by the school. But some of these cases end up involving the police, and some Prevent trainers I've spoken to say that that shouldn't really happen unless there's an immediate risk to the child's safety. Plus, these children, remember, aren't accused of any criminal behaviour.
So, since teachers were placed under this legal duty last July to report fears of extremism or radicalisation, how often are they doing it?
Well, between July and December last year, the Department for Education's Counter-Extremism Helpline recorded around 150 calls and emails from concerned school, college staff and parents. And that works out at about 2 calls every school day. These weren't calls requesting advice. They were calls reporting potential extremism.
Wow, 2 every day? That sounds like a lot.
Well, the government's independent advisor on terror legislation, David Anderson QC, has actually raised concerns about what might be happening in some schools. Giving evidence to a parliamentary committee earlier this month, he spoke about what he perceived as the acute crisis of confidence among some teachers about the way they're expected to deal with Prevent and the concerns that some schools might be overreacting, and he called for the strategy to be reviewed.
OK, let's speak to Christine Blower, who's General Secretary of the NUT, the National Union of Teachers. Morning, Christine.
Good morning.
So how do your members in the classroom regard this Prevent duty?
OK, well, first of all, let me say that obviously teachers know that they have a moral and professional duty to ensure that children are safe. But that would be safe from sexual grooming, from any kind of nefarious approaches and so on. But I have to say that we discussed this Prevent duty last Easter at our conference in the National Union of Teachers. And we said at the time that this was disproportionate and it would be a big problem. And the idea that there are 2 calls a day coming under it, I think demonstrates that actually there is a problem. And of course,
well, it might demonstrate that, of course, there's a lot of extremism and a lot of radicalisation going on.
Well, the thing is, you could believe that that might be true, except that very many of these go no further. And the examples that you gave, I think, were interesting ones. The one about the young woman coming back from North Africa, clearly that was a pattern of behaviour. And in fact, the school dealt with that on a basis that ended up quite positively. The thing about the other much younger children is it's not a pattern of behaviour. It's a one-off where you would actually expect the school to have dealt with that and not made a referral outside. But there is there's a further difficulty that our members face, which is that we believe that because of this Prevent duty, there are young people themselves who are, as it were, self-censoring, who are not coming into school to discuss things that they otherwise might have discussed, and neither are teachers taking the opportunity to have discussions, because on the one hand, teachers don't want to open up an area where they might come into difficulty, and young people don't feel that they can discuss things where, if there were a genuine discussion, they might get information which would give them other and, you know, perhaps, as we might say, better ideas.
So the pupils are afraid of opening up debates with their teachers in case they get reported by the teacher under their prevent duty. And likewise, the teachers are also fearful of opening up these debates because once they get to a certain level, they fear they might have to report the pupil rather than continuing the discussion and engaging in debate.
Yeah. Now, here's a really good example. I mean, it happened a while ago, but it's a very good example. When the atrocities happened in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo atrocities, so I'm not talking about the Bataclan Club, I'm talking about when those people were shot in the Charlie Hebdo, the magazine offices. One of our members who works in a school that's largely Muslim expected, because normally the girls would come into school and talk about what was going on in the newspapers, expected them to come in and talk about that. But in fact, they'd been warned not to mention by their parents, not to mention any of this, because if they came in and talked about that, they might be considered to be potential terrorists. Now, I have to say, I'm familiar with that magazine, Charlie Hebdo, and, you know, people have every right to be offended by things. Of course they don't have the right to behave in the way that those people who shot journalists do. Of course they don't. But if you don't have a safe space in school to discuss things, then it's more likely that people will be prey to those things which go on, you know, quietly in their bedroom and on the internet, which perhaps even their parents don't know about.
On DAB Digital Radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live investigates.
Good morning. On 5 Live Investigates today, combating extremism in schools. We've revealed that since last summer, when teachers were placed under a legal obligation to report fears of children being radicalised, there's been an average of 2 calls a day to a government hotline. But we've also heard complaints that some teachers are being oversensitive and placing youngsters under suspicion when there is no need. Beginning your comments on this, Claire Savage alongside me. What are people saying, Claire?
Well, Julia from Tiverdale in the West Mids says, she's sorry that Muslims are upset, but with Islam becoming more prominent in this country, we need to get a grip of things, she says.
This is from Timothy Jenkins. To what extent has the inability to spell words like cucumber or terrace led to these problems? Well, we are talking about very young children in those cases, Tim. Tony Coffey says, we're so hysterical about terrorism that we're now frightened to be sensible. There is no stopping this juggernaut now. And Jeremy Sleeth says, what? Cops being sent to a school when someone clicks onto an EDL website? Are we in a free society or Orwell's 1984 or North Korea? Keep your comments coming. Text us 85058 or email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. Now, Claire, one issue teachers have raised with you, I know, is the training they receive and whether it's enough to equip them to spot genuine cases of radicalisation. What training do they get?
Well, the government's guidance to schools says it's important that staff have prevent awareness training. And they say, as a minimum, the member of staff in charge of safeguarding should receive awareness training. And there's a 50-minute online course that all teachers can do. And, of course, they can get one-to-one training as well.
But there's no requirement for every teacher to be specifically trained in this.
Yes, there's nothing in the guidance that says all teachers must have training.
Let's get a word again with Christine Blower, General Secretary of the Teachers Union, the NUT. Christine, is this enough? Simple question, really.
Well, the fact is that the prevent training that exists is incredibly variable. And as you say, not everyone has to do it. And we've got examples of teachers who've had quite good face-to-face training where the whole staff, the teachers, and indeed the teaching assistants have all been trained. We've also got examples where, frankly, it's not at all clear that the people doing the training knew what they were talking about, let alone, you know, actually being able to communicate this very well. So it is immensely variable. And really, if you're going to place a duty on teachers, it would have been important for the government to talk with the professions through the unions about what prevent training might look like. Because, you know, everybody recognised that it's important to keep children safe.
Christine, thank you. Christine Blower from the NUT. Claire, have we got any figures for how many people are being referred to police under prevent?
Yes, I have. And the most recent figures for the 6 months up to September last year show 3,000 people were referred to the police for assessment on whether preventative action was required. 2/3 of those referrals came from public bodies such as schools, health and social services. But we don't have a breakdown as to how many of those were from schools or related specifically to children.
But if there is a real concern about a possible link to extremism, extremism. What happens then?
Well, if it's felt early intervention is really needed, then the child, with their parents' consent, might be referred to something called CHANEL. Now, this is the government's anti-radicalisation programme, and last year, nearly 2,000 children aged under 15 were referred to it, and 400 of those children were under 10 years of age.
Gosh, so that is a lot of young people being referred to this anti-radicalisation programme. Let's speak to Rasad Ali, who is a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, Combating Extremism. Rasad, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So what do you make of what we've heard on the prevent duty and the prevent strategy so far? Teachers and some families telling us that it's being overzealously being interpreted.
It's a very difficult question you just put there. There's probably a lot of different aspects to what we're looking at. First of all, this has become a statutory duty, and so teachers are trying to grapple with trying to understand the context and application. But I'd just like to step back before looking at prevent specifically, and I think we forget the safeguarding role generally, that we have safeguarding responsibilities, and what we found in general within schools is placing those responsibilities explicitly and having processes in place helps deal with these things.
Well, does it though? I mean, we heard from Christine Blow from the National Union of Teachers saying that having as a specific legal duty means that sometimes teachers are scared to discuss issues that they would normally discuss with pupils, and that children are coming to school scared to raise contentious issues with their children, with their teachers, who they should be able to trust, because they fear the teacher may be under a legal obligation to then report them to the authorities.
So just to go back to what I was saying, so in terms of safeguarding responsibilities, that we found, and we know this, I mean, every single area, whether it's related to sexual exploitation, whether it's related to drugs, whether it's related to gangs and violence, that actually safeguarding responsibilities are important and a means of early intervention. And we know this, that actually whenever an individual is not suspected, but we're concerned for that individual, that early intervention may help. And similarly, safeguarding responsibilities require us to actually intervene, whether it's through social services or the police. And whatever public agency is required to do so, it has to engage. And I think we know that in general. So that's the point I was going to make, that actually it is a necessary requirement. And the point that I think was made on your show earlier, that actually this is no different to anything else, and whether shouldn't the individual whose behaviour has changed, who's completely changed the manner in which they dress, etc., they're becoming isolated, they attend at school, shouldn't there be some kind of engagement there anyway?
Well, Rasad, I mean, the argument again from the union was that exactly that, that of course the school would engage with that and would normally have engaged with that, and that it's somehow inappropriate for it to be somehow triggered by this anti-radicalisation duty.
I think it's quite simple. I think, again, this is, there's a lot of the kind of vitriol and, you know, I don't know how best to describe it, but slightly reactionary language about this and slightly emotive. If we just step back and look at it in that way, then actually what we're really saying is there's an additional responsibility placed on safeguarding. And that additional responsibility, you'd think, common sense-wise, is a normal, regular responsibility. So if you have a young child who's making statements or demonstrating that they have, you know, they could possibly be in danger themselves or in harm's way or talking about harming other people, that there'd be a responsibility to do something. And so merely adding it on isn't what is creating the trouble. I think we have to step back and look at this. It's not happening in a vacuum.
Okay, Rasad Ali, thank you very much.
In a political context.
Rasad Ali, thanks very much indeed for your time this morning. Claire, what have the government said?
Well, they say they're committed to protecting children and young people from the risks of extremism and radicalisation, and the prevent duty is entirely consistent with schools' existing responsibilities. School staff should use their professional judgment in identifying children who might be at risk of radicalisation and to act proportionately.
Claire, thank you. Coming up, a whistleblower in the UK's longest trading standards trial talks on national radio for the first time about the dodgy sales tactics he was used to con householders out of their cash.
Across the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Investigates with Adrian Goldberg.
Now, who hasn't had an offer like this? The chance to buy a new roof or windows at an incredible knockdown price with just one catch. You have to place your order today or risk missing out on the bargain deal. It's the kind of technique practiced by sales staff up and down the country every day of the week. But what if the company concerned has never charged the full price and is just making it up to con often elderly and vulnerable householders into having costly and unnecessary home repairs? Well, in that case, they're breaking the law. And two directors of a company in the West Midlands were recently jailed for using aggressive and misleading tactics. And the conclusion of the country's longest trading standards trial has exposed some of the worst aspects of the direct selling industry, where sales staff come into your home. Sally Chesworth has more. So which firm was this for starters, Sally?
This was a company called Summit Roofguard Limited, based in Birmingham. Two directors, Sarah Beadle and Martin Evans, were jailed earlier this month after being found guilty of unfair, misleading or aggressive commercial practices. Four other people who worked for the company were also convicted of trading standards offences, and they were given suspended jail sentences. And what was remarkable about the case was the discovery of a 14-point guide prepared for sales staff. It was effectively a blueprint of how to swindle vulnerable customers by making them pay vast sums of money for repairs that weren't needed or were vastly overpriced.
And I've had a look at this 21-page document, Sally. It tells sales agents how to secure a deal. It's been seen as more widely significant than just this company, isn't it?
Trading standards experts say that they've long suspected that these manipulative techniques are used regularly by some companies. And I stress some companies, not all, operating in the direct sales industry.
And one of the key elements they tried to use was something called the fear of loss. Now, what exactly is that?
This is where they tell customers that the job really should cost X thousand pounds, but for today only, that price is being heavily discounted just for them. Householders were made to feel that if they didn't sign up there and then, they'd miss out on the bargain.
Yeah, and I'm thinking there'll be listeners up and down the country who've maybe bought double glazing or had a roof extension, whatever, being told similar things. This in itself isn't that unusual, is it?
No. What's made it illegal is that there was the higher price, which customers were being offered this huge discount on. It never existed in the first place. It was just made up. So the huge discount was on a price that no one ever paid.
And the judge described the sales routine as a sham and a pantomime.
Yes, the rep would go through a long-winded process to assess the customer's house as a show home and see how much of a discount they might be able to offer. They took loads of details. They asked whether there were schools or shops nearby. In the patter, only the best A-rated homes got the biggest discount. But funnily enough, every home got that A rating.
And therefore qualified for the massive discount on the price that had never existed in the first place. And the 14-step guide tells sales staff at this point at which the customer gets the A rating for their home and qualifies for the big discount, it tells them to get excited.
Yes, and one victim said they were frightened because a salesman started jumping up and down in the house and screaming euphorically.
Now, this company had been operating for a number of years. Why didn't this come to light any earlier?
Well, the firm insisted on a confidentiality clause in the contract aimed at keeping the price secret from the victim's family and neighbours or anyone else who might want to raise the alarm.
Now, we should make it clear that not everyone connected with Summit Roofguard Limited followed this 14-point guide and indeed the dodgy sales tactics it encouraged. Sales rep John Campbell-Muir was one of those who refused. He became a key prosecution witness in the trial. Morning, John.
Morning.
So how were you encouraged to get sales, firstly? What was this 14-step guide?
What you've got to understand, Adrian, is Summit Roofguard, they didn't really like employing experienced reps. They tended to take on people who had never really been in the sales industry. The only reason I got the job is because I obviously knew one of the directors from previously before.
You said, John, that you wouldn't follow this guide. What did they say to you at that point?
Well, what basically happened is I had constant arguments because the first thing I argued about was the price, because I found the price that they were actually first saying was extortionate for the sort of type of work, having had a company myself years previous where I was fitting it as a one-man band business. And then when I went to work, but they justified it to me by saying, oh, we've got to pay for this office and the sales staff. But, you know, I mean, I'm talking, you know, a considerable amount of money they were making, you know, from their sales, you know, and it, to me, never just justified it. And then I went through the 14 steps, found out that the guide that we had to fill in was just being thrown in the bin. No records were ever being taken.
This was the guide where, this was the assessment guide on which all of the customers were getting an A rating and therefore qualifying for the discount.
As I say, I worked there 2.5 years and I've never known a customer who didn't get an A rate grade.
How would you describe the culture of the company, John?
To be honest with you, the company when I first joined, I believe, was a good company. It's set up very, very professional. The director, who I know, Trevor Pratchett, you know, he was a genuine sort of guy, and same as Martin and Sarah. When I started noticing things, I started questioning things. I then would get shouted down, banned from meetings. I was put about the company that I was moaning Muir. And it was just I kept asking questions. And as I say, the judge said that Mr. Muir kept asking questions and kept ignoring him.
John, thanks very much indeed for your time this morning. What was it like then to be on the receiving end of this company's sales pitches? Well, Chris King from Dudley Trading Standards, who prosecuted Summit Roofguard Limited, told me about some of the high-pressure sales techniques and the victims of those techniques.
One of the worst cases was an elderly lady from Leicester. She was in her 80s. And the salesman stayed in her home for 3 hours. For two of those hours, her carer was there, but then her carer had to leave for the last hour. She didn't really have any recollection of the sales pitch that she'd received. But paperwork shows that she was quoted something like £17,000-£18,000 to replace her fascia, soffits and guttering. A fair and reasonable price for that, according to our witness, would have been £3,755. That was the initial price quote. Assuming it was necessary, and it wasn't, it didn't need doing. She was told that she could be offered a discount if photographs were taken, and together these discounts brought the price down to £10,000.
Still more than double the true value of the work.
That's right, that's right.
And what was the upshot?
She explained she didn't want credit because she didn't want to pay any interest charges. She paid a deposit of £100. She signed a document that she believed was to authorise the work. In fact, she had signed a finance agreement.
Even though she had said she didn't want a finance agreement.
Yeah. She thought she was signing a document to authorise the work. And the total charge for the credit shown on the finance agreement was £25,634.80.
So the £10,000 job would mushroom up to £25,000 once all of the interest had been taken account. She didn't want to pay interest. She was duped into putting her signature onto a finance agreement, so work that should have cost less than £4,000 was going to end up costing her more than £25,000 through a finance agreement that she had said she didn't want.
That's right, exactly. And this is an 85-year-old lady with her carer. Her nephew assisted her in writing to the company to cancel the order. He claims he was accused by one of the staff of the company of wanting to cancel so he could have his aunt's money for himself. Then Summit telephoned this lady and told her that they wouldn't accept the cancellation and they were coming out to see her and sending a salesman out to see her. She was led to believe that if she cancelled, there would be some kind of forfeiture. So it was, again, part of the aggressive commercial practice. Once they were trying to sell to you, they would be extremely persistent and they would be very reluctant to let go.
That sounds like an incredible story, Sally, doesn't it? A lady who didn't want finance, ending up with a finance and agreement, and £4,000 or less of work costing her £25,000. Incredible.
Yes, the credit being applied for in this woman's name was about £10,800 over 120 months or 10 years. So the agreement was based on 120 monthly payments of £212.79, which tots up to that enormous figure of £25,634 that Chris King has just mentioned.
Yeah, and that leads us to another part of the story that's causing wider concern.
Yes, the finance agreements the company offered were backed by Barclays Partner Finance, but part of Barclays Bank. Now, there's no suggestion that Barclays had any involvement in the sharp practices of Summit Roofguard Limited or knew what the company were up to. But step 7 of the 14 steps we've been hearing about makes it clear that for sales staff, being able to use the Barclays name was a major asset and added credibility to their sales pitch.
Yeah, let's hear from Chris King again from Dudley Trading Standards.
Within the process, it's quite clear that customers are being encouraged to take out finance even if they could afford to pay for the goods. in general terms, we would have concerns about anyone who's been persuaded to get into a finance agreement unnecessarily or when they can afford it. And we would advise all consumers to consider what they're signing up to.
What do we know about the company's relationship with the bank?
It's described as a partner agreement. This is called Barclays Partner Finance. And that written into the sales process was the fact that you tried to sell Barclays Finance when you were selling the deal.
Are there lessons for Barclays to learn from this case?
We would encourage any financial institution that offers credit in this way to ensure that safeguards are in place to make sure that the sales process is being followed, are lawful and not misleading.
Are you confident that was the case in this case?
I think that there's merit for further investigation.
Of Barclays' role?
Of what went on.
Interesting. Let's get a quick final word with John Campbell-Muir, who worked at Summit Roofguard Limited before turning whistleblower. John, very briefly, how important in selling products from the company was its relationship with Barclays?
As I say, we was always led to believe that we were actually selling Barclays Finance. It wasn't until the trial that I actually discovered that there was a partner in between the two. For me, all the training, every aspect of what our training was based on, everybody we had to try and sell finance to.
Interesting stuff, John. Thank you. What are Barclays Bank saying to us, Sally, this morning?
We've had a statement saying Barclays Partner Finance followed all the correct policies and procedures and full checks were undertaken for the company in 2005. It goes on to say, when we were alerted by the Trading Standards Office in early 2014, we investigated the concerns and terminated the relationship immediately. If any customer feels that they've been affected by this, then they should contact Barclays Partner Finance to discuss their concerns.
OK, very interesting stuff. Should say that Summit Roofguard Limited has now ceased trading. A lot of comments coming in as well on the prevent duty being imposed on teachers to report any pupils they fear might be at risk of radicalisation. We're so hysterical, says Tony, about terrorism that we're frightened to be sensible. There is no stopping this juggernaut now. Thanks for listening to the Five Live Investigates podcast. And don't forget, if there's something you want us to investigate, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.